This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The U.S. women's national soccer team won its third World Cup title this weekend in a convincing win over Japan.
Played in short on the ground, quick shot, goal! Carly Lloyd again. The whistle, Holiday will strike. Sending it low again, the flick from Johnstone, loose. Another goal! Carly Lloyd again, 2-0 U.S. Krieger sending in, intended for Morgan. Lloyd with Morgan streaking. She's chipping the goalkeeper! Off the post and in! Hat-trick for Lloyd!
Yeah, it was easy to put that tape together because 4 goals in 16 minutes, it was all in one place. For Sunday's World Cup final, the American women would go on to win by a score of 5-2 over Japan. That seals another chapter of the team's dominance since FIFA created the Women's World Cup in 1991. And the rise in the popularity of women's soccer in the United States is thanks at least in part to the women who built the program in the 1990s. Two of them are with me now. Both of them played at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Carla Overbeck was the captain and played defense for U.S. women's national team. She has an Olympic gold medal as well as 2 World Cup titles. Carla, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, who was a midfielder for the national team from 1996 to 2006. She has 2 Olympic gold medals and a World Cup title. Cindy, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We're taking your phone calls today. If you have a question or comment, you want to talk to either of these two fine athletes about their careers or about women's soccer in general, you can talk about the game on Sunday. Any of it is up for grabs today and part of the conversation that you can join at 877-962-9862 or send us an email, sot@wnc.org. You can tweet us at hashtag AskAChampion. Cindy, this weekend's match, a highest scoring women's final in World Cup history. What did you see in that team? You were there, right? You were in Vancouver.
I was there. I was there for the final. It was fantastic. And I mean, just so proud of this team and the way they conducted themselves throughout the tournament. They were getting a lot of negative feedback from a lot of different people, especially through the opening rounds. But they stuck together as a team and continued to perform and advance. And that's the name of the game in the World Cup, is to make sure you advance. And they did that. And then being there in the stands for the World Cup final, it was unbelievable. Growing up, I had a poster of the 91 World Cup championship team on my wall at home, and then 99 I was fortunate to be a part of the team, and then this past weekend to be in the stands and watching them play and win in the fashion in which they did was just unbelievable.
As a player, as someone who has played this game and been in the finals like that, when they take such an early lead, could you allow yourself to think, oh, they got this one?
As a player, I would have never done that. But as a fan sitting in the stands when you have no impact on the game whatsoever, when we were up 4-0, I did relax and say, we've won this. We just won a World Cup.
Carla, you prided yourself on good defense. This had to be a thrill for you to see a team that had only, 3 goals scored on it for the entire championship run, right?
That's right. Obviously, Hope Solo was one of the best goalkeepers in the world, or won the award for being the best goalkeeper in the world. And the entire defense in front of her was incredible throughout the whole tournament. And I think that's the reason why they got out of the group of death, because they did so well defensively. And then, the game against China, we started putting a little bit more pressure on the teams, starting with our front runners, all the way through our midfield and then the defenders. And we started to play much better as an entire team. But absolutely, the defense was stellar the entire tournament.
This has to be, if you're trying to promote soccer and explain why this game is such a great game, it's kind of a dream come true, because for players and coaches, defense is everything. I know that. But sometimes for fans, that's the hard part. A 0-1 game, not so much fun. Or is it nil? But the fact is, if you can score a lot of goals, and it's the home team scoring the goals, and the key to your success up until then had been defense, wow, that's a dream come true, right?
That's right. And, the longer these games go on without a goal scored for your team, I think it just continues to put so much pressure on the backs and the goalkeeper, just because if they make a mistake, it'd be in the back of the net. So, a lot of times the attackers and offense can do the defense a favor by getting an early goal or two. And and then the defenders and keeper will relax it a little bit, because if they do make a mistake, then we'll still be winning.
So you've been playing this game for a while. Again, been in championships, been in the Olympics. more than 25 million people watch this on television. That's a huge number. It's more than watched Game 7 of the 2014 World Series, more than watched the last game of the championship basketball NBA series. So a lot of people clearly watch this game maybe for the first time or were not soccer fans. Did they get a good glimpse of what women's soccer really is? Is this pretty typical of the high level of soccer? Carla, let's stick with you for a minute.
Absolutely. You know, I think it didn't hurt that we scored 4 goals in 16 minutes. I think that kept the viewers going because it was so exciting. I mean, it was incredible. The team had been getting a little bit of grief because they had not played as well as they could throughout the tournament, but they saved their best performance for the last game. And I think the 25 million watching, got a great show.
Cindy, what do you make of the fact that there was criticism? The fact is that people are weighing in on this team. It tells you something about how far the game has come, perhaps.
Yeah, I love it. I think it means we have really arrived as a sport. We're being treated just as all the other sports are being treated. Our players are being critiqued. Our coaches are being critiqued. Our federation's being critiqued. For me, it's welcomed because that means we're on par with what every other professional sport is in this country and worldwide is. With popularity and more people paying attention to you, you are going to get that criticism. So I welcome it. It means more people are watching and paying attention and are passionate about the sport.
That's it. You've got genuine fans, people who couldn't possibly play this game, sitting back, drinking their beer, telling you how you should be playing.
Exactly.
Bring it on. Hey, Cindy, take us back, will you, to when you grew up. You grew up in Tennessee, right, and got
Correct.
The soccer bug. Tell us about getting involved in soccer.
Yeah, so I have three brothers, and I was that annoying sister that wanted to do everything my brothers were doing. And luckily, one of the things they were very involved with was sports, and specifically soccer. So I started at a really young age. I was 3 years old. I was the only girl on the team. Finally joined a club team, I think I was around in seventh grade, and then continued on playing, played Olympic Development Program, and then joined the national team youth program. I was on the U16 national team and just made my way up from there.
So not only were you competing against your brothers, but you had the rare opportunity of growing up in a family where you were not only allowed but encouraged to kick the ball in the house. Am I right?
I was, yeah. I literally had a soccer ball at my feet almost all the time, and if I didn't have a soccer ball at my feet, it was a basketball in my hands. My poor parents, they never had anything nice out in the house because they knew it would be broken. I would sit at the dinner table and have a soccer ball at my feet, passing the ball back and forth between my feet while I was eating dinner. Sitting still was not an easy thing for me.
Carla, what about you? I understand you played a lot of sports and really weren't set on soccer early on, were you?
That's right. Soccer wasn't my first love, but I loved basketball and volleyball. Played those in high school. Didn't even play on my high school soccer team. Was on a very good club team called the Sting in Dallas, Texas. Oh, yeah. You know, I grew up just like Cindy. I had three older siblings, two brothers and a sister. And I was kind of that annoying kid, too, where I wanted to be just like they were. Any sport they were playing, I wanted them to include me. I think a lot of times out in the yard, they'd kick balls at me, but I tried to survive. And
that's how you play good defense.
That's right. That's right. So,
kids, if you're listening, if you want to be a great soccer player, be as annoying as you possibly can to your
that's
parents.
Right.
A little tip on the state of things today. Thanks for that, Carla. You tell us about how you came to UNC, because it's interesting. When you came here, I mean, this was before BS, before soccer, right?
Right. The recruiting process is much different these days. North Carolina was really the only program that did recruit me. And I wanted to, because I'm such a homebody, stay in Texas and just go to Texas A&M because that's where my siblings went to college. And, finally after the process was kind of toward the end, my dad sort of encouraged me to go to North Carolina and just get away from Dallas. And he thought it would be good for me. And thank goodness I did. I grew up, obviously, the first year and a half was not smooth, but, you know,
You mean just making the adjustment to North Carolina or soccer?
Well, the whole defense had graduated the year before I got there, and they had just lost a national championship. And so here I was, a freshman, getting thrown into the mix right away. Usually freshmen kind of ease their way into a starting spot, but the defense had graduated, and so I got thrown out there, and I made plenty of mistakes. And, you know, fortunately, they stuck with me and they had more confidence in me than I had in myself. But things worked out and I stayed and now I live here.
they is the team, and Anson Dorrance, who of course is the coach and really put the whole package together.
That's right.
Tell us about him. Did he find you? How did he recruit you, or how did he know that you would end up being a good soccer player?
Just like Cindy, I played in the ODP development in my state of Texas, North Texas. And we came to North Carolina, or we came to a regional camp, and he was the coach of the North Carolina state team. So our Texas state team played against his North Carolina state team, and they weren't very good back then. and he ended up being the regional coach. And so he chose me out of, you know, a group of lots of young soccer players to play on his regional team. And then from that team, he took it to national team camp. And so I guess he liked what he saw in my play and recruited me to come to the University of North Carolina.
Talking about women's soccer today on The State of Things, Women's World Cup and the rise of women's soccer in the United States. Our conversation is going to continue in a moment. But if you have a comment or any kind of questions for my guests, Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow-Cohn, please give us a call at 877-962-9862. You can email us at sot@wnc.org or send us a tweet with the hashtag AskAChampion. Talking about women's soccer on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with two world champions of soccer, Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow-Cohn, are former members of the U.S. women's national team who helped build the program in the 1990s. Carla and Cindy were both on the team in 1999 when the American women won their second World Cup title in front of a sellout crowd at the Rose Bowl. The talent and drama involved that year marked a milestone, not just for women's soccer, but American sports.
In the back, the United States organization is the key, and the captain, Carla Overbeck, is in the running there. In the midfield, look for Michelle Akers to have a big game, and up top, Mia Hamm, Tiffany Milbert, and Cindy Parlow in their usual combination.
Chastain reversing all the way to Mia Hamm. Hamm brings it down, still on it with the left foot, and the goal!
Here's Milbert. Drives it across. Chastain!
Is a moment in American culture, not just for women's sports, embracing women athletes in this magnitude.
The winner of the 1999 Women's World Cup will be decided on penalty kicks.
July 10th, 1999 probably was a defining moment in not just women's sports history, but sports history.
On the referee's whistle, we lead with a shot and a goal. China's up. So here's Carla Overbeck. With only 7 international goals career. Not a good goal scorer, but good on penalty kicks. The shot and the goal. One apiece. Ying will go next. The first starter for China to take a penalty kick.
She had almost a desire to not want to be doing this at all. And I could see it. It was the strangest thing. And I remember thinking, this is the one.
The shot. The USA could win the World Cup on this next kick. Chastain will take it. She missed a penalty kick against China in the Algarve Cup, and they lost that game.
I don't know if I can describe this well enough in words, but it was like it happened very quickly, but it was in slow motion.
There it is. Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow-Cohn are still with me, giving each other high fives and reliving every moment of those highlights back in 1999. We're taking your phone calls, 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wnc.org. You can tweet us at hashtag AskAChampion. So let me ask you, I mean, pretty exciting game to be there together. Well, let me ask you, Cindy, actually, how you came to UNC, because we talked about the fact that both of you played at UNC Chapel Hill.
Yeah, my story is a little bit different. I was on the youth national team, and Anson Dorrance, the coach at UNC, was the full national team coach at the time. And we had a training camp right next to the full team, and he brought me up from the U16 national team to play inter-squad scrimmage with the full team. And so that was the first time he saw me play. And then I learned that one of my teammates, Siri Mullenix, was skipping her senior year of high school to go to UNC early. And I thought to myself, that sounds like a good thing to do. So I called up Anson and told him who I was. I didn't know if he remembered me, that I would like to come to UNC. And he basically told me to call him back next year. And then I told him, no, I want to come this year. So I ended up skipping my senior year of high school, entering UNC as an honor student, and the rest is history.
See, they love it when you skip your last year of high school, but your last year of college, then they're not so excited about that.
Right.
Of course, you didn't
I did return to college and finish my degree.
We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Hugo is on the line from Raleigh, and you may know Hugo. Hello, Hugo.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say hello to Carla and to Cindy. How you doing?
Doing good. Great. How are you?
Good. Haven't seen you guys in a while, but
I know.
You definitely remember the Raleigh Wings that you were on.
Would this be a former coach of yours by any chance?
No, I was just running the team.
I see.
Bill Palladino was the coach, but It was a fantastic team. And I couldn't resist calling when I heard you guys on the radio today. Great USA team performance again. I just wanted to get your input on two things. Perhaps you can tell us the impact of the coaching staff on the team. We haven't heard much about the coaches. And also, my second question would be, how are you guys involved right now in soccer?
All right. Thanks, Hugo.
Well, I'll start with the second question first. Carla and I are both still coaching in soccer. I coach in the Chapel Hill Durham area for a club called Triangle United. So I coach youth on the girls' side. I coach U8 to U18s, and I actually coach Carla's youngest daughter is a U13 team.
She's the best coach ever.
What makes a good coach?
Well, I think there's a lot of qualities that go into coaching, and I think it's impossible for one coach to have them all. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's important to have a staff that surrounds you that has the strengths that you don't have. And it takes a really strong, confident coach to surround people around them that are better at things than they are. And that's one of the great things about our 99 team and Tony DiCicco, is he was such a confident person, and he knew what his strengths and weaknesses were, and he surrounded himself with people that were good at things that he wasn't, and he let them do their job in it. So for me, it was just a fantastic thing to see at such a young age.
Carla, let's talk about what it takes, because we've talked about Anson Dorrance and how important he is to developing UNC's women's program and to women's soccer, or soccer in general. He obviously saw talent in both of you. He recruited you. To what extent is the coach responsible for knowing young talent, and how much of the coach is developing that talent? In other words, what can a soccer coach do to make you a better player or turn you into the player that you became?
Right. Obviously, you want to get kids that are athletic, that have personalities out on the field, you know, good personalities. Because a lot of times if they don't have, they talk about that it factor. A lot of times if they don't have that, it's hard to kind of instill a will in them that they want to get after it. And so I think when you're recruiting, you look for those type of qualities, you know, what players can they take games over by themselves? Can they put their team on their shoulders? You know, how do they respond if they're winning? How do they respond if they're losing? So I think lots of, kind of qualities go into recruitment. And, just talking about coaches, I'm an assistant coach at Duke University and have been for 22 years, I think. And it's funny because you're their parent away from home, and it's like you're a psychologist and you're their friend and you're their coach, and you're all these things combined into one. And at the same time, you know, you have to get the best out of them to perform at the level in which you want them to perform. And so it's a fine line. You know, I've had a great time. You know, Duke has been great to me, and the kids that, you know, Robbie gets to come to school there, and they're great soccer players. They're great people. And after soccer's over, they go on to do great things.
Let's take some more phone calls now. Jack is in Sanford. Hello, Jack.
Hi. Yes. Hi, Frank.
You have a question for us?
Yeah, sure do. First of all, I'd like to say hello to Carla and Cindy. Nice to talk to you. And I just want to ask a question. What do you see as the biggest challenge to the development of soccer in the United States going forward after this fantastic victory this past Sunday?
All right. Thank you, Jack. Cindy?
I think the biggest challenge is the size of our country. And we have so many young girls and young boys playing soccer, and that to have a number of quality coaches, and as vast as our country is and as and the millions of kids that are playing soccer, it's difficult to get quality coaching at every part. So having a way to develop these kids in not necessarily a systematic way, but in a way that we could, that when they get to the U14 or U15 or U16 national team, whatever it may be, that they've had a similar education. And then it's that way in Germany, it's in that way in Japan, but our country is so large that it's hard to have that. And we don't have that, and we will likely never have that. So we have to find a different way to do it. And I think U.S. Soccer is looking at those different ways and how they can come up with a different way to raise the level of the youth game here in the States, so that when they make that jump from the U16, U20 national team to the full national team, it's only a jump in speed, but in terms of an education, they've already had that.
Because when I was growing up, there weren't any youth teams. It was the national, the full team or nothing. And so I think the U.S. has made great strides in that part of the game, and, you know, identifying talent throughout this country. But I think, it, like Cindy said, it's just hard because, you know, getting quality coaches to sort of implement what they want to see at that national team level is very difficult.
Well, and tell us how it's changed, too. You were on that 1991 championship team, and in terms of the interest and the number of people who showed up, you know, in the stands and watching, I mean, things have changed. Give us a feel for what it was like to play in 1991.
I mean,
fans, I mean, maybe how many, 10,000-15,000?
Not even. You know, promotion of the games weren't as great as they are now. We would go overseas and people would say, whoa, you know, women play soccer. And, you know, we came back from winning the championship in China in 91. We played in front of thousands of people. China did such a great job promoting their tournament in 91. But when we came back to the United States, no one even knew really we had a team. And so it has grown tremendously. I mean, 25 million were watching on TV the other night, and the women put on a show. We cannot be more proud of this team.
How important was it when the tournament came to the United States and you were playing in some very big stadiums? Because there was pushback. FIFA didn't think you were going to fill Giant Stadium in the Rose Bowl, right?
That's right. And fortunately, Marla Messing and Donna De Verona had the vision that, you know, if we put this team out there, people will come watch them play. And, you know, we would go every city we went to, we would do promotional tours and we'd do clinics and everything trying to promote the game. And, you know, in the press conference, we would say, yes, you know, people will come watch us play. We're going to fill the stadiums. And after it's over, we're thinking, I hope they come watch us.
But it meant that you were doing the work. You were signing the autographs, running the clinics, all that kind of promotional stuff that really brings people to the stadium.
That's right. And that's what our team, we were so genuine about that. And we knew that to be successful, we had to be that way. But I think we all wanted to be that way. I mean, if we could touch a child's life in a positive way, we were going to do it.
And you were filming those stadiums. And again, the FIFA folks at FIFA thought you would never do it. And those stadiums were filling up. So we're talking about 80,000 people
right,
watching the game. We got a tweet from Keith who wants to know if artificial turf makes a difference and how you feel about that, Cindy.
It does make a difference. It changes the game. It changes the way players go after a ball. That changes the pace of the ball on the ground. It changes whether you're going to slide after a ball or not. So it does change the game. And while I'm very happy that the U.S. won, I do think FIFA made a mistake by making them play on artificial turf.
What about injuries, too? Don't you aren't you more prone to, I mean, it's less forgiving.
That's right. It's not as forgiving. And you heard Abby during the tournament say she didn't lay out for that ball because she was playing on turf. And that's too bad because, you know, is it wrong for FIFA to do that? Yes. Are there discrepancies in the game? Yes. But I think once the tournament started, they were just focused on winning that thing.
Kind of chicken egg. You talk about the discrepancies. The women's U.S. national team won $2 million for winning. The men won $35 million. You win $8 million. The men won $8 million for being bounced out in the first round. So there's huge disparities in the amount of money that's being spent.
Very much so. And even back when we would make the we'd qualify for the World Cup, the women's team across the world would get nothing, and the men's team would each get $1 million from FIFA.
Just for qualifying.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. That's changing. Do you think now, again, 25 million viewers, you know, many of them tuning in for the first time, perhaps. Do you expect to see changes, and will that drive the game if we can, if we reach parity or closer to parity when it comes to the amount that's spent on women's soccer, it's going to make a difference?
I do. I think especially in developing countries, because they need money to invest into their women's side of the game. And we're seeing how quickly countries that start investing in the women's side, how much they're improving and how quickly they're improving. I mean, all you have to do is look at Japan, look at England, look at France, Germany. I mean, they are improving very quickly. And that's because they've decided to invest in the women's side of the game.
We're taking your questions today. Laura is on the line from Carrboro. Hello, Laura. You have a question for us?
I do. Hi. I'm a mother of a young girl, about four, and I've always thought that soccer would be a fantastic sport to enroll her in. But I've heard some recent debate over what the best age to enroll kids into that kind of sport is, and I was wondering if you had any input.
All right. Thanks, Laura. Good age. Carla?
I started at the age of five, and I think if they show some interest in it, start them, you know, whether it's soccer, basketball, volleyball, any sport. I know, Cindy, you started younger than I did.
Yeah, I started at age three. I played on my older brother's soccer team. So it was very different then. You didn't have U3, U4, U5 at that time, which I think you do now. At that time, it was all U5s were together, then all U7s. So there's a lot more kids playing now, so you can divide it up by age. But I don't think you can start it too young. I think she's fine to start now, and the earlier she starts, and if she's having fun with it, run with it.
Yeah, and I think the key is both of you, again, expressed a lot of interest. So I wonder if there's my guess is that the worry might be that injuries, that you might sustain some kind of injury because of that sustained, whatever it is that you're doing in soccer that's particular to those muscle groups and joints. Would it make a difference if you're deeply interested? If you're kicking the ball under the table at every meal, I mean, does that make a difference about when you should start your child?
Well, I'm a big proponent of playing multiple sports. I think it's important to play multiple sports, especially at the youngest ages. There's been a lot of studies done on this and how important it is to have variety in the type of activity that you're doing. I played basketball, I played soccer, I played softball, and I swam. I played basketball and soccer all the way through high school. One of the reasons why I chose UNC is because they would let me play both basketball and soccer. I didn't end up pursuing my basketball career because I made the national team my freshman year at UNC. But there's a lot of studies that show how important it is to have these different skills.
Is recruiting getting any better? And are we now at a point where we can start looking at younger players and start watching them in the way we do maybe men's football or basketball?
Well, I mean, I think it's, unfortunately, it's kind of trending toward recruiting younger kids. Mm-hmm. I'm a big supporter of, you know, taking the pressure off of these kids. And I think recruiting has gotten a little bit out of control in our sport. But until the NCAA does something about it, I think, you know, it's going to continue to trend where you're signing freshmen in high school.
And the problem with this is not only recruiting of these kids, but it's development of these kids, because now coaches at younger and younger ages are saying that we have to win. We have to win. Mm-hmm. So we got to get in this higher division so coaches will come watch us play. We have to do this. We have to do that. And if you're only focused on winning, you're not focused on developing the players.
We've got a number of questions about concussions and soccer. And I wonder if you are concerned about that and if there's anything that can be done what parents should know as they're getting their kids ready.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about it. I actually suffer from post-concussion syndrome, had to retire due to post-concussion syndrome stuff. And we are trying to do some things. I'm part of a campaign, Safer Soccer, for no heading under the age of 14. So teaching kids the technique of heading in practice with a lighter ball, but then actually not introducing it in competition until later, because about 30% of concussions in soccer happen during the act of heading, not necessarily heading the ball, but head-to-head collisions, elbow-to-head, falling down, hitting your head on the ground. So delaying that a little bit longer. And then also I'm developing a company called Inver, which is looking to develop an inner ear device to detect impact and rotation.
And looking ahead, again, 25 million viewers. The money's getting a little better. People are watching the game. Are you optimistic? I mean, again, you have to assume that some of the people are watching because the American team was there. So is this are you optimistic about the future for women's soccer, Carla?
I think so. And, you know, because they had so many viewers, and I think I even read a stat that they stayed – three quarters of them stayed 30 minutes after the game had ended. So they wanted to continue to watch the broadcast. I think Fox did a great job, you know, getting all the games on TV. They were live. I got a chance to watch not just the U.S. team, but all the teams play. And that was something that had never happened before. You know, 24 teams were entered in this tournament. And that's the most ever. I think women's soccer is definitely on the upswing. And talking about all the money and everything, I mean, we would have played for free. We love the game. Don't tell the Federation that. But we would have. I mean, we truly love the sport. Yeah. And, you know, we saw kind of what the men were getting and what we were getting. And we were in a good position to kind of, you know, test the Federation and see if we could get paid somewhat equal to what the men were getting. And it's
really
not
great
even close.
To talk with both of you. Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow-Cohn, World Cup champions, former members of the U.S. women's national soccer team, and Olympians as well, gold medal Olympians. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about experimental dance, a project that is coming to Asheville. Please stay tuned to The State of Things.